Okay, so good morning, everybody. Please, there's food in the back. Anybody that wants to get up in the middle of the share and grab yourself an additional bite, please feel free to do so. So this is a continuation of what is, Baruch Hashem, a monthly medical halacha chabura. And as we said last time we spoke about end of life, I said this time we would talk about beginning of life issues. Beginning of life issues, every single one of the highlighted subjects that I said we would talk about is hours and hours of shiur in itself. So this is going to be a quick, rapid overview to get us out by 10 o'clock, a very rapid overview of the issues. And then I'll be happy to take specific questions as we go through them. If I see that you can answer the questions throughout. If I see that there's just too much information to provide, then we'll have a part two to this. We may have a part two anyway, because there really is tremendous interest, and the technology today has dramatically changed this field, probably more so than in any area of medicine. In end of life, okay, we have some new advances technologically that allow us to prolong certain patients' lives. It's beautiful, Baruch Hashem, wonderful. Beginning of life, you're talking about a person that would not have been created, would not have had a life, and Baruch Hashem now can have 120 years of life. And this is Maisim B'chol Yom. This happens every single day. So this is a fascinating subject. And I want to start off with the famous Gemara in Shabbos that I'm sure everybody in the room knows, and that is, when we're 120, we're going to get a final exam. Right? Everybody likes to know what's on the final exam. So Gemara tells us the final exam has four questions, really six questions. One of the questions is, Asakta Befiria Verivya. Did you engage in trying to bring more people into this world? Now, many people mistakenly think that the answer to that question is, did you have a boy and a girl? That's the minimal definition of period of Arivia. A person was successful in having a boy and a girl. Their opinions that say two boys, their opinions say two boys, two girls. That's totally incorrect. Nobody's going to be going up to Shemayim. You'll go to the right if you have this number of children. You go to the left if you have that number of children. You go down if you don't have any children. Rachmana litzlan. That's absolutely an incorrect understanding of what does it mean, Asakta Beperia Verivya. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zatzal, Nigris Moshe, already writes that you don't control this. A person can try all his life, is desperate, both the husband and the wife. We know that's one of the most challenging things for a married couple, if they can't have children. So this couple's, Erlich a couple, Avram and Sarah didn't have children for many, many, many years. Rivka and Yitzchak, yesterday's parish, didn't have children for 20 years. Does that mean that those Gedole, Yisrael, the Emos and Avos, they didn't pass the final exam if they didn't get the schus of having a child? It says by Avram and Sarah, they had a girl too. Her name was Bakol. So if they didn't have that medrash saying that they had a child by a girl by the name of Bakol, does that mean that Avram Avinu, Sarah Imenu weren't Zocha to fulfill this mitzvah? Of course, Rav Moshe says the answer is obviously not. It has nothing to do with whether you have children or not. It has to do with, did you try to have children? Some people, they never can find the shidduch. But they tried. And that's why the Marsha says, and this I think is maybe the most important thing I'm going to say today. The Marsha, I've said this many times, this is the most important aspect of Asakta B'Piri V'Rivya. Did you engage in Piri V'Rivya? The Marsha says, has nothing to do with you. Did you try to make shidduchim? Did you try to have other people get married so they could have children? That's what the Marsha explains is the question, the answer to the question, the Sakta Beferia Rivia. Everybody can do that. And that's really the opening over here in the whole question is the beginning of life. Beginning of life begins before conception. Beginning of life begins even before marriage. Beginning of life even begins before dating. My Rebbeim always taught me that if you don't daven for Shiduchim, during the 9 months of pregnancy, you're already too late. You just wait till the baby's born and then you start davening for a shidduch, you're already 9 months behind. The person always has to daven for shidduch and the person therefore always has to be involved. You don't have to belong to a shidduch organization. You don't have to belong to a fraternity of people that get together and try to make shidduchim. Everybody's capable of doing that. Everybody knows somebody and they have friends that know somebody and everybody has to attempt as best as they can. That's what it means, vasakta b'piri v'rivya. So that's really the beginning of life. Now we'll get to the point where Baruch Hashem, the couple is engaged to be married. So let's start off with some of the first things that occur even before marriage. And this is a subject somebody specifically asked me to speak about, which I was going to, but I'll throw it in right up at the beginning. And that is, what should the young couple be doing in terms of genetic testing prior to their already getting married? And this is something that until maybe 60, 70 years ago, wasn't even a Shiloh. What do you mean, what do? You get married and you dive into HaKadosh Baruch Hu and hope that everybody's healthy. There was no such thing as genetic analysis of the husband and the wife, or the future husband and wife. And today we have much more complex capabilities in terms of doing genetic analysis of the sperm, genetic analysis of the egg, genetic analysis of the newly formed embryo before it's implanted. We'll get to that. But right off from the start, a normal, healthy young couple, no reason to think that there's something wrong. What should they do? So unfortunately, through a great tragedy, an unbelievable chesed, an unbelievable ramification came out. Rabbi Joseph Eckstein, Shlita, is Zohar Latov. Can't say enough about this great man. He, Nebuch, had four children born with Tay-Sachs. This was before the understanding of how you can prevent Tay-Sachs. He had four children born with Tay-Sachs. He had, many children. Four of his children born with Tay-Sachs. So anybody knows the basic understanding of the way that this disease is handed down, it's what we call a recessive gene, which means that if a parent has it and the other parent doesn't, nothing will happen to the children. At worst, they'll be carriers. But if mommy has the gene, daddy has the gene, there's a 1 in 4 chance that the baby will get the bad gene from mommy, the bad gene from daddy, and the baby will be born with both of these genes for Tay-Sachs, and this is true for many other diseases as well, but Tay-Sachs was the one where this started from, which is a major genetic problem in Ashkenazic Jews. And therefore, as a result, 1 in 4 of your children are going to have this disease. That's a statistical likelihood. A person could have 10 children and get lucky and have none. You can have 10 children, get unlucky, have all 10. So I think Rabbi Eckstein and his wife, I think they had 10 or 11 children. I don't remember exactly how many. I've met him a number of times, spoken with him a number of times. And Nebuch, he had 4 children. In those days, if you went into hospitals, this was probably in the 50s, 40s. 60s. 60s too. I'm saying, but when this first came out, so the wards in Brooklyn hospitals, in Jewish hospitals, or in areas where the Jewish people were filled, Nebuch, with Tay-Sachs babies. Filled. You had entire wards, Nebuch, with babies. They all died. Doctors Tay and Dr. Sachs were two doctors that identified this syndrome. One was an ophthalmologist because of certain eye findings, and the syndrome was named after them. And Nebuch, there were many, many. This was one of the most common Jewish, Ashkenazic Jewish recessive genes that was a problem. And Nebuch, as a result of that, many Jewish children had no way to know how to prevent this or that it occurred. Both parents are healthy. Both parents are perfectly healthy. No Tay-Sachs baby lives. There's a rare, something called a form frust, which is like a mild form of the disease, which is a little bit different than the standard form. Every now and then, you can have these mild forms of the disease. Leave that aside. No baby ever survives Tay-Sachs. They all die 2-3 years old, Nebuch. So in this situation, the parents are perfectly healthy. They have no idea that they're carriers even. They didn't do testing. And Rabbi Eckstein said, I have to do something about this. No family should have to go through the tragedy that he personally went through with his wife. And what did they do? They investigated, they looked into it, and they came up with a system of checking people. The technology was now available that you could do a genetic analysis on the prospective husband, the prospective kala, and you could go and check to see if, in fact, they were carriers. They're perfectly healthy. You would never know a carrier is perfectly healthy. You have one good gene, that's all you need. Kosh Baruch Hu gave us a spare. If you have one good gene, you're going to be perfectly healthy. And therefore, with no way to know from a physical examination. So they came up with the genetic analysis. And he came together with Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Zatzal. And they figured out this Dor Yisharim testing, which was a very, very beautiful, simple, and easy way to prevent these disasters from occurring. And what they did was they had all the prospective students or anybody that was interested in doing this. I remember being tested through Dar Yishar. And you went and got tested to see if you were carried, but they didn't tell you the results. You got put into a data bank. In those days, that meant somebody entered it by hand, and somebody then had to go cross-check by hand. Now today, you click a button, everything comes up. And all the boys that were in this program, they encouraged, Ramosha encouraged everybody to do this. And all the girls, prospective college, at an age, before they were obviously dating, or right at the time that they came into the parisha, right? We're in the parisha of the parisha, so it's appropriate for us to discuss this. And they would check, and they would go out on the first or second date. They didn't check. But as soon as they saw, oh, I'd like to go out again. Before, there was a strong emotional attachment. They would go, each call up the Dor Yisharim number. They'd give their number. Each party would give their number. Number 27, number 43. You're compatible, you're not compatible. If you're not compatible, then they both had the recessive gene as one of their two genes. And therefore, they'd have a 1 in 4 chance of a child. Better not to go further with the shidduch. They weren't yet emotionally attached. They went out once or twice. And that was the plan that Rav Moshe set up with Rabbi Eckstein. And Rav Moshe wrote a whole tshuva about this, where he says that people don't understand this. Now, this may still be true for populations today. They don't have the sophistication. They don't understand what it means to be a carrier. And Rav Moshe said this could cause tremendous potential anxiety and troubles in people. Oh, I don't do anything with that family. They're carriers, that family. And it could destroy families. And Rav Moshe understood that if people aren't sophisticated and they don't fully understand what's going on, it's better to do this in a newer type of a way. Nobody knew who the problem was. They would say, you're not compatible. They didn't say it was the boy. They didn't say it was the girl. They weren't yet emotionally attached. They only would do this with people that weren't emotionally attached. If you were dating already for a while, if you were ready to get married, Dor Yisharim wouldn't test you. You'd have to go to a laboratory and get yourself tested. That involves a tremendous amount of problems. Because what happens if they're not compatible, but they're already in love? They already have a wedding date scheduled. What do you do in that situation? So we'll talk about that momentarily. But that's how Dor Yisharim was set up. It still works today. They've added on many additional tests that we can now check for. And this has prevented who knows how many countless thousands and thousands of tzaris in people that would have had in families that would have had this anxiety and this nervousness and nebuch, children with fatal diseases or very, very serious diseases. That is the Dor Yisharim approach. It is sanctioned by Rav Moshe Feinstein, and it is still a very, very good methodology to prevent many, but not all, potentially preventable genetic diseases for populations where that still works. On the other hand, Rabbi Bleich Shlita and many, many others have come out not in favor of Dor Yisharim and say that people should not go with the Dor Yisharim path anymore. Because there are many, many more. You can have all these various types of genetic testing now. There are well over 200 genetic diseases that you can test for that are recessive genes that are not going to have any evidence of illness in the parents. But if you have two, again, a mother and a father, they each have this recessive gene, and then they have they get married. There's a 1 in 4 chance every one of their children will have such a machala. And therefore, there are those that advocate, and this is perfectly good and very appropriate in more sophisticated communities where people can understand that if I did 225 tests on every person in this room, statistically speaking, everybody here is going to be a carrier for something. Now, some of them are very, very rare. And historically, when people got married, even though both have been potentially a carrier, it's very, very rare to have this rare disease. It occurs in 1 in 10,000, 1 in 100,000. To have 2 1 in 100,000 people end up and meet up, or still give me 1 in 4 if they have a child, but to have 2 carriers, it's very rare. So Dor Yisharim doesn't check for all of the rare ones. They don't check for all the ones that are not fatal or very serious, whereas you can do genetic testing and even rule out some less serious, albeit still very problematic diseases. And I tell prospective young couples, if they come to me, when I give shiurim on this, say both methodologies are perfectly good. One is an open methodology, and you have to be willing to deal with the results. And you have to know when and how to tell those results to the other person. The beauty of Dor Yisharim is that it's formalized, it's a system. And in those worlds which use Dor Yisharim, The shidduch is read. They go out the first date, second date. They think there's a potential. They check the numbers. The numbers say compatible. Keep on going. The numbers say not compatible. Nice to have met you. And they go look elsewhere. Whereas in the much more expansive type of testing programs, somebody has to actively get tested. They get a printout of their results. And at some point in time, they have to arrange with the other side, well, what do you have? What do I have? And let's see, are we compatible or not? Again, it's more broad. It takes more illnesses into account. It doesn't just come smoothly. And when do you do this? Guy has 7 recessive genes. Whoa, that's terrible. I don't know if that's terrible or not. They're very, very rare. It can have zero implication. At what point do you provide that information? Day 1, day 2, day 17? After you're married? At what point do you provide this information? So this is the problem with the more open type of a testing, and I tell each couple, they have to know what they're doing. If you're doing Dar Yisharim, you have to know this well up in advance. If you're not doing Dar Yisharim, if you're doing the open genetic testing, so the couple has to know when they should get tested. They have to know if the other partner's been tested or not. If somebody's clean, they have zero recesses, they could marry anybody. So then they can just go in. If they know you're absolutely clean, the likelihood of somebody not having a single recessive gene is not that high. So if you have only one, you have two. You have to know, does the partner that you're prospectively going out with have the same mismatch? And then it's potentially a problem. So you need to know what to do in that situation. And there it's much more open to interpretation. When is the couple going to do it? After day 4? They already like each other. They're already talking, serious situations. They have to date 14. So that's the problem with that system. More broad, more open, more information. But at the same time, the system or the process how to do this is a lot more complicated. And that's the wonders that Rabbi Eckstein, Zohar Latov, he started this whole idea of testing to remove. And today, Baruch Hashem, I have never seen a baby in the hospital since I'm a doctor with Tay-Sachs. Baruch Hashem, almost unheard of to have such a baby born today, because almost everybody is tested for Tay-Sachs before they get married. And Baruch Hashem, this was the most common Jewish recessive disease. And Baruch Hashem, it's totally prevented. Rabbi Eckstein himself, as an individual who was given a tremendous challenge in life, took that challenge and destroyed, removed a machalah from all of Klal Yisrael. So that's an amazing thing that a person can do when he's given a challenge. Some people, they're destroyed by the challenge, and other people, they do something for Klal Yisrael from the challenge. It's just amazing. So now let's talk about what, Rachmana Litzlan, happens if a couple, in fact, do have 2 recessive genes, and there's a 1 in 4 chance that their children will have this illness. So if it's date 1, so say goodbye. Very nice to have met you. Why do we have to go any further? You're a very nice person. Kinayin hara. There are many nice people out there. You're obviously not my basheret. Let's go elsewhere. That's very easy. They're already engaged. Unfortunately, this happens all the time. When they get serious, whoa, somebody reminds them, you better look into genetic testing. And what do you do in that situation? So there's basically 2 very difficult choices. Very, very difficult choices. One is to call it off. Very difficult. Couple likes each other very much, young couple. They're madly in love with each other. They have a date. They want to get married. There's a 1 in 4 chance that every one of their children will have some terrible machala. So sometimes they call it off. Very emotionally, very, very difficult. It's terrible, terrible, terrible thing to happen to somebody. They say they want to go forward. So what do you do in this situation? If you want to go forward with such a marriage, there's a 1 in 4 chance that your children will have this terrible machla. So again, if you're going forward, there's 2 options. Let HaKadosh Baruch Hu decide. Do nothing. There's a 1 in 4 chance. Some couples choose that route. Today, Baruch Hashem, I don't think many couples would choose that route. But in the olden days, that was pretty much all the option that you had. You could adopt. You could decide not to have children, which requires you to use birth control your entire married life while the wife is still fertile, which is huge halacha l'maisa questions. It's not a simple thing to do. And they would adopt. That was the other option. Or today, Baruch Hashem, we have something called PGD, pre-implant genetic diagnosis. And this is an unbelievable breakthrough in terms of our technological abilities to prevent such a baby from being born. As I said, there's a 1 in 4 chance that a baby will be born with this. So what can you do nowadays? You can do genetic testing before the baby is put inside the mommy. So what does that mean? It means you must do in vitro fertilization. Now, they have to discuss what is in vitro fertilization. 40, 50 years ago, if a couple couldn't conceive, so there were very, very limited options. When I was growing up, everybody knew people that were adopted. The kids in your class, they were adopted, right? The Gemara tells us that if you raise somebody else's child, i.e. you adopt somebody else, it's like you fulfilled Peru or Vu. You're considered a very great person. Kol HaKavod to anybody that took somebody else's child in and raised them and adopted them. It's an unbelievable chesed. It's not the ideal situation. Most people want to have their own biological legacy. Right? I heard one from one of our Rebbeim. Why was such a drive to have children? Because in children, you can see your own flaws. Very, very deep and profound idea. When you see a kid doing something wrong, you notice it right away. My Rebbe said, look at yourself. You've had the same exact flaw probably, which you never saw in yourself. Oh, you're always doing things in a shortcut type of a way. Oh, you're always doing things fast and sloppy. Right? You notice that in your kid right away. Maybe look at yourself. Hashem gave you a little mini me, right? So you can see the flaws in yourself. Very profound and interesting idea. Not the only reason that people should have children, but it's a byproduct, a very nice idea. You get to see yourself in a way from the outside because your kids all are very much like you, and you can see what you're like a little bit. And instead of only trying to focus on correcting your children's habits, maybe you should stop for a second and think, maybe I need to correct my habits. Okay, a little musa on the side. In the olden days, if you wanted to have a child and you couldn't, there were very, very few options. Moshe Zatzal wrote about donor sperm. That was one of the first advances you could create in the situation where the husband couldn't have children because it was a pure problem to the husband. By the way, fertility issues, they're evenly split roughly between men and women. Statistics are roughly that about 40% of the time when you have an infertility problem, it's the husband. About 40% of the time, it's the wife. And don't think I can't add. That only adds up to 80%. The other 20% is a combination of husband and wife. That's a rough guide in terms of where the infertility problems lie. In any given couple, it may be 100%, obviously, one versus the other. It depends on a numerous factors, which you can't go into right now. That's more of a medical lecture. In the olden days, if it was purely the husband's problem, the husband didn't have a zera, he didn't have sperm that were functional for whatever the reason. Maybe the husband didn't have testicles, he had cancer. Sometimes this is a problem. Nowadays, if somebody, Rachmana Litzlan, if they're going to have to remove a person's testicles because they have testicular cancer, which is unfortunately a problem in sometimes in teenagers, or sometimes if you have what's called undescended testes and they're not recognized, so then they can the temperature inside the body is too high to allow the testicles to mature properly, and then they become infertile if it's not recognized. That's why it's very important that when these children, it's very common that the testicles not descended on one side, sometimes it could be both sides, that they either do an operation or they follow them to make sure they descend, because inside the body, the testicles, it's a little bit too warm and they won't be able to mature properly, and you'll end up destroying the testicle. So for any reason, whatever, that the father in this couple couldn't have sperm, so then the only eitzah was have donated sperm, have what was called artificial insemination with donor sperm. You can sometimes do it with the husband's sperm. If there's another problem, a technical problem, so they could sometimes use the husband's sperm, but they have to do it in an artificial sort of a way. But Rav Moshe wrote a number of tshuvas about artificial donor insemination with somebody else's sperm. Now, the whole question arose, is this adultery? The woman's a married woman, and she's being impregnated with somebody else's sperm. So most of the posts said it's not an issue of adultery. And most of the questions were raised regarding paternity. Who is the father of this child? Is there a father in halacha? And that led to a great, great controversy as to whether it was preferable to use donor sperm from a non-Jewish person versus donor sperm from a Jewish person. The Mailas and Chisronos are obvious. If you're using sperm from a Jewish person, so then that person is the father of this child. But nobody knows that he's the father. Those things were kept very, very secretive. Even today, you want to open up those type of records, it's not a simple thing to do. Adoption records are very difficult to open up. To find out whose sperm it was that you used from the sperm bank is not a simple thing to do. And the concern in halacha, if the father is a Jewish person, is that this child is going to grow up. It's a nice boy. The baby boy is born as a boy. He's going to go out and find the girl. She lives in Seattle. She lives far away. But that's where the donor sperm came from. And he's going to marry his half-sister. That's why the Gemara says a person And min hadin, never recommended. Min hadin, a man can have two wives. They weren't supposed to live in separate cities because that could lead to problems. The children may not know each other. So it's always a concern that if you have a Jewish sperm donor, that the child that grows up may end up marrying a half-brother, half-sister, depending on what gender there is. So Rav Moshe had recommended using non-donor sperm. Non-donor sperm, the child is Jewish because it's born to a Jewish mother, and it removes any halachic concerns about marrying a half-brother, half-sister. It doesn't remove the biological concerns of marrying a half-brother, half-sister, but if the sperm donor was not Jewish, there's very, very low likelihood that this child is going to marry that person's child. Because they're not Jewish. Everybody converted, it's always a possibility, but at least from a biological point of view, it would be very unlikely. From a halachic point of view, it has its share of problems. There was a famous, unfortunate, very big controversy when Moshe came out with his psak that people were unhappy with his psak, and people sometimes, tamidim of rabbeim, sometimes don't act in the best of ways. And the whole controversy not worth going into at this point in time. But in any event, that was the first modern genetic type of issues that came up with paternity. Today, Baruch Hashem, assuming that the husband can give sperm and the wife can give sperm, in our case, we're concerned about the baby being born with a recessive disease, so what you can do is you use in vitro fertilization, which, again, came about 40, 50 years ago. Baby Faye, right, the big news. Now today, it's commonplace. Tomorrow's daf. Those who do the Daf Yomi, and this is a good chance to just give a plug. I can't give enough plugs to this. We're starting the new cycle of Daf Yomi in about a month, and it's just a wonderful thing for everybody to get involved in doing. So tomorrow's Daf actually talks about this very, very important problem of in vitro fertilization. And this comes up a Shiloh all the time, which different posts can have different psak halacha too. Tomorrow's Daf talks about a cesarean section child is not considered a normal Leida, which it certainly is not, but certainly considered Leida, it's considered birth, but does it have the halachic status of being considered giving birth? One practical nafkamina, you got to come to the daf tomorrow morning if you want to hear all this stuff, one practical nafkamina is that we don't consider it to be docha Shabbos. A baby that's born on Shabbos via cesarean section would be normally having their bris the following Shabbos. So everybody paskins in that situation, we don't do the bris on Shabbos. Baby born from a cesarean section doesn't have its bris on Shabbos, even if it's the eighth day. Certainly, if it's not the eighth day, nobody ever has a bris on Shabbos. But normally, the eighth day is Docha Shabbos. Here it's not. So when in vitro fertilization first came out, so Rav Shlomo Zalman Zatzal, and I discussed this with Rav Shechter Shlita, and he agrees with Rav Shlomo Zalman's opinion. Rav Shlomo Zalman wrote an article in Asiyah, which is a medical journal dealing with halacha. Asiyah is the term that the Gemara uses for a doctor, Asya. So he wrote an article saying that a child born from in vitro fertilization is also not Docha Shabbos. And that a child born from in vitro fertilization, even though it's a normal, quote, vaginal delivery on Shabbos, you don't do the bris on Shabbos. Now this is a shocker, because I've asked many Marlim, do they ask this question to all the prospective couples? Mazel Tov! They call up the local moil, their person that they want to do the bris for them. The moil will always ask, is it a cesarean section? If it's a Shabbos, if not a Shabbos bris, it doesn't make any difference. If it's a Shabbos, a yontif bris, so it's only docha Shabbos, a yontif, if it's halachically able to be docha, which is a normal eight-day bris. So they always ask, was it a cesarean section? Cesarean section? I just had the Shabbos. It came to me maybe a month ago. Somebody asked me, oh, it was Sukkis. A little bit more than a month ago, not much. So it was a Sukkis question. The bris would have been on Sukkis. So he wanted to know when exactly she should do the bris. I said, one question. Was the baby born by cesarean section? He said, yes. I said, don't worry. You don't have a problem. It's going to be on Chol HaMoed. You don't do a bris on Sukkis if it's from a cesarean section. So he said, oh, I didn't know that. Very good. Many people don't know that. The Moelim know that. But when Rav Shlomo Zalman, and I'm not sure he was necessarily the first one to come out with this, but he's the first one that I saw coming about this, he said, you can't do a bris of in vitro fertilization in a baby that was born vaginally, a regular normal delivery. The baby is born on a Shabbos, which everybody says, the bris will be next Shabbos. So Shlomo Zalman, Rav Shechter Shlita, they both say, no, the bris isn't done on Shabbos. It's based upon this Gemara from Tamar in the Daf, based upon a Gemara elsewhere, Rabbeinu Chananel, that basically says that if the introduction of the baby wasn't normal, if the baby didn't come out in the normal way, then there's not Docha Shabbos. It's not called a Leida, in the normal sense of the word. It's not called a birth. that you can do the bris on Shabbos. Not all poskim disagree. There are great poskim that disagree and say, no, you can. It's only a yotzei dolphin. It's only a cesarean baby, a cesarean section baby that you don't do the bris on Shabbos. But if there's in vitro fertilization, that doesn't affect anything. So again, you have different opinions. So if you hold like Rosh Shlomo Zalman, does that sound like Rav Shechter Shlita? So then the moel has to ask the question. How was the baby born? Now, this is not something that's normally publicized. Today, it's already much more frequent and common. But certainly, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, people didn't publicize the fact that they couldn't have children in the regular way. They had to have it through in vitro fertilization. So this was a great shaila. Yeah? So tomorrow's daf. You have to come to tomorrow's daf. They talk about that. So the vast majority of the times, a C-section would kill the mother. So the Gemara assumes that in some situations it didn't. They sometimes could remove the uterus. I don't think they ever had, in the times of the Gemara, somebody that had a C-section and then a year later, 2 years later, had another baby. That they didn't have the technology for. But it seems from the Gemara that there were some people that survived the C-section. Not sure how, don't know the details. The Gemara's simple understanding would be that some people survived a C-section back in those days. They probably removed the uterus and somehow they had enough surgical technique that they were able to save the mother's life. I don't know, again, the details. It certainly wasn't commonplace. I would argue that the vast majority of the mothers would have died under that section. They would just do it to save the baby. Oftentimes, they did the C-sections after the mother died, and they would take out the baby.
And the Gemara says that if it's either the baby or the mother, you save the mother as long as the baby's head is not out.
Yeah.
Why would that be allowed, a C-section?
So, first of all, the mother is allowed to undergo a C-section if she wishes to, and they did this with the understanding in the case that they would hopefully save the mother's life. So in those situations, the mother has a choice. I don't know if I touched upon it last time. Rahman al-Latzan, a mother who's diagnosed with cancer while she's pregnant. And the doctors tell her that it's a tragic situation. If we give you chemotherapy now, the baby will die. It'll be an abortion. Or we can wait till after the pregnancy's done. Your cancer will have spread more. The likelihood of your surviving will be less. But the baby will be born healthy. The cancer's not affecting the baby. It's only the chemotherapy that would affect the baby. So the post can discuss that situation, and most of the time they say it's the mother's choice. If the mother wishes to, she can have the abortion, she can take the chemotherapy, which have a much better chance of success if you don't wait 8 months, 9 months, 7 months till the baby comes out because the cancer will have spread. The mother's allowed to say, I'll take the chemotherapy in that situation, even though Nebuch will cause the demise of the child. Or in that situation, most of the time, the mother has the right to say, no, I don't mind taking my chances, let the baby have a normal gestation, let the baby do it normally, and then the next day I'll start the chemotherapy, even though there's a lower success rate in that situation. So there is a choice that might be given. So in this situation as well, Mustama, the mother, they feel that there's a chance that the mother will survive the C-section, again, a rare event, and that's how they could do it. It's also possible the mother would die anyway. They say the mother's bleeding out. If they don't take the baby out, both the baby and the mother are going to die, so then you're allowed to do something to the mother. In any event, this... Yeah,
surrogate mother.
Oh, surrogate mothers. Well, that's the next step. We'll get there. I don't know if we're going to get there today. Maybe we'll need to do a part two if you're interested. That's for a show of hands afterwards. If you want me to do, next time we're going to do Shabbos in Yom, we can always push that off. We scheduled it only for three times. If we want, we can do a fourth time if people are interested. So let's get back now. So the in vitro fertilization has its own series of shilas with it. But under a standard situation, for whatever the reason, the mother and the father can't have a child regularly, or because of genetic problems, you now do in vitro fertilization. But now we have the added kunz, we have the additional thing that this child is going to have a 1 in 4 chance of being born with a recessive gene that both parents give, the 1 in 4 chance that both parents give it, and the child's going to be born, Rahman al-Islam, with Tay-Sachs, with Gaucher's disease, or whatever, Nebuch, with the 200-plus machalos that the child could get. And you know that that's going to happen 1 in 4 times. And they don't want to play the lottery. They want to say, we only want one child. Oh, we want two children. We'll take a chance. Only 50%. No, they don't want to take any chance. So why should they? So today, what you can do is you in vitro fertilize, meaning in vitro means in the test tube, literally. You fertilize take the sperm from the father, the egg from the mother. You can fertilize a number of eggs in the test tube. You let them grow a little bit for a few days. And now you can remove cells from that growing embryo without damaging the embryo. Embryo will form fine, will continue to form fine. You take off a cell or two. I don't know exactly how many they take off. I think they take off one cell from this, what's called a trophoblast. Take off a cell or two. And they examine it with genetic diagnostic capabilities. Pre-implantation, before they put it back inside the mother's body, They do diagnostic testing, genetic diagnostic testing. And they see, does this embryo, that one cell has the same genetic material as every other cell? And they check and see. So we have five samples in front of us. Five fertilized eggs in front of us. I check number one, number two, number three, number four, number five. There's a 1 in 4 chance at every one. They check number one, this trophoblast over here has Nebuch gotten one recessive of bad gene from each parent. That's not a good embryo to implant. They chuck it in the garbage. Aye, abortion, ritzicha, murder. Min hadin in halacha. Pre-fertilization inside the body. Pre-implantation. It's fertilized. An egg that's fertilized outside the human body is not considered halachically alive. Practical nafkamina, this just happened. This exact incident just happened. The power goes off on Shabbos to the freezer when these eggs are frozen. So if there was a human being that the ICU, the power went off, you put them on an emergency generator, you do everything, chal Shabbos left and right. That's called pikuach nefashos, because it's a live person that's going to be impacted. Does the halachic status of this fertilized egg have the status of being pikuach nefashos? The answer is lekuli alma, no. And therefore, you're not allowed to be mechal Shabbos. You just have to flip on the switch of the abortion generator. That's an issa d'oraisa. You're not allowed to do it. Either embryo's going to die. It's not alive. It's no different than, I'm going to lose $100. You're not allowed to be mechal Shabbos to save $100. Now, you can't ask an Nakum. You can ask a guy to do something for you. Amir Eliakum, in that situation, would be allowed. You live in Eretz Yisrael, there may not be an Akum right around. So this actual maisa just happened recently where the power went off. So that shows you the halachic status. It's not considered a life at that point in time. When does life start? Implantation. It's not considered a life in the test tube. But in the test tube, therefore, you can check. So this one, Nebuch, has both recessive genes. You throw it away. There's no isser whatsoever. Sometimes women, trying to get pregnant, they do multiple cycles, they have multiple eggs, and Baruch Hashem, they had 5 kids, and they don't want to have any more kids. So you throw the eggs away. There's no issue whatsoever. Even if they're fertilized, you're allowed to throw them away. Certainly if they're not fertilized, you can throw them away. I don't mean that casually and dismissively. I'm saying from a halachic point of view, the eggs have no halachic status of being alive. So you check trophoblast number one, no, that's not a good one. Number two also, statistically, 1 in 4, this one also no good. Number three is good. And you have no other genetic problems with number three, because they can do all sorts of genetic testing. So there's no mismatch, there's no incompatibility in trophoblast number three. That's the one they choose to implant. And that is a perfectly halachically acceptable way to get around creating a Tay-Sachs baby through natural taking your chances, 1 in 4 chance, or whatever, Rachmona Litzlan, genetic disease the couple has. So just do this. What's the shaila? Don't do any genetic testing. Let everybody get married, and let everybody do in vitro fertilization. Well, that's ridiculous, obviously. Number one, it involves slight risk. You're giving drugs to the mother. You're doing a procedure on the mother. It's not the normal way, and that brings up the halachic issues. It's not the normal way, so you don't want them to get pregnant the normal way. They must be on a form of birth control. Halacha and birth controls are not a simple subject. So yes, there are halachic indications to allow birth control, but the default position is there is no heter to do it. You need to have a halachically acceptable reason to do it. You need to ask your local Orthodox rabbi what your particular issues are, whether that's halachically acceptable, for what period of time. Once you have a heter one time to do it, doesn't mean you have that heter the rest of your life. And those shilas are very complex shilas, not general Klali Shir shilas. They must be asked to an Orthodox rav. And sometimes they're simple shilas, sometimes they're much more difficult shilas, and they must be asked to an Orthodox rav. And he has to paskin the shila. Now, it's critical to understand that if you're going to go this route of in vitro fertilization to solve your genetic problem, that means for the rest of your life, while they can have children, once the wife reaches menopause, then it doesn't apply anymore. She can't have children anymore, so there's no concern that you'll have a child born with a genetic problem if she's no longer fertile. Man's always fertile, or at least his fertility doesn't diminish totally. A 90-year-old man theoretically has viable sperm. A woman, when she hits somewhere in the age of 40 to 50, there's a very, very, very marked decrease in the viability of her eggs. It actually starts to decline probably from age 30, 32, which is the egg freezing, which I'm not going to get to today, which is a whole interesting subject. And in that situation, a woman's fertility declines to the point where at some age, let's pick 50, she physically can't have children. There's always exceptions. Like this lady had a baby at 52 naturally. Yeah, statistically speaking, when you hit 40, 45, very, 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 very low likelihood. You hit 50, extremely low likelihood. Almost nobody gets naturally pregnant after 50. Today with surrogate motherhood, you could have a 55, 60-year-old mother. The uterus works fine. And with hormones, you can do a lot of things. So you could actually use them as a surrogate mother, but they can't get naturally. So then, at that point in time, the husband and wife no longer have to use birth control. They get married at 20, they have to use birth control for 30 years because of this genetic problem. And that's why it's so much smarter not to get involved in these problems, to figure them out before they get married, before they get emotionally attached to each other. And in this way, you can prevent all sorts of terrible, terrible, terrible halachic decisions as well as emotional decisions that come up. It's very difficult to be on birth control for 30 years of your life. There are risks involved in that. It can be uncomfortable for numerous reasons. And it's certainly never a lechatchila approach. Lechatchila, you should figure out these things before you get emotionally attached. And this way you don't have to go into these problems. And that's going back to the genetic testing, what methodology you wish to use. And as we develop more and more tests, so unfortunately, sometimes there were tests that nothing was available for, and then a couple never has such a baby. And they find out this is a recessive gene. They're married 5 years. They had three healthy kids, and now the fourth one has this problem. What do they do? So then you have the same shaila as if they were unfortunately only finding out about this when it's too late. And then you have to ask shailas. And according to almost all the poskim I've ever spoken with, I think all the poskim I've ever spoken with, so that it's acceptable to use PGD as the means to prevent the baby from being born. And it's 10 o'clock now, so I'm going to end over here. I think if people are interested, we'll do a part two on this because there's a tremendous amount of stuff. So then we'll make this a four-part series. We'll, Mir Tzashem, carry it over an extra month at least. If people want more, we can always do more. So next time, instead of Shabbos, we'll talk still about part two fertility, and then we'll do Shabbos the time after that. Because there are many, many interesting subject matter that still come up. So with this PGD, you have to also decide on who you want to do this for. Because today, and this we'll leave to discuss next time, but a little teaser over here. Today you could do PGD because you want your son to be a linebacker for the New York Jets, which may not be such a mile nowadays, but you want your child to be 6'4", 250. Your genetics would have made the child be 5'4", 150. And you want to have him as a linebacker. You have brown eyes. You want your child to have blue eyes. You have a certain type of gene that's not life-threatening, but you have a small nose in your family. You want to be a big-nosed family, or vice versa. So we can already start manipulating all sorts of non-important. And then, I'll leave this as the real teaser. What happens if you want to have a certain gender? We could give you today, from a technological point of view, all boys, all girls, 50% boys, we can pick designer babies. We can give you exactly the sex of the baby you want, the eye color of the baby you want, give you a much likely, more highly chance that you'll have this physical factor versus that physical factor. What does halacha say about that? There are many, many interesting shailas. This will be the teaser to come back next time. I thank you very, very much for listening today. And Amir Tzashem, I hope this is interesting.